is in it happened when you say it happened, where you said it happened. So it's important to hold on to copies of your original video. So we know that a lot of activists upload videos to YouTube, and then they often delete their copies of the video because they need the storage space. So it's understandable. But YouTube, as you know, takes videos down all the time for various reasons. So if you don't have a copy, it's lost. And you also want to hold on to your videos in their original format, because like you said, there is metadata that's embedded in those video files by the camera that shows when and sometimes where the video was shot. And that is important for demonstrating the authenticity of your video.
So where do you download it to?
Well, the easiest thing to do is when you have your memory card or your mobile, your phone, you know, plug it into your computer and copy the files directly onto your computer without using any sort of processing or specialized software. It's that simple to keep the original file. And then once you've copied it onto your camera, you want to off your camera. You want to make sure you have two copies on two separate storage devices, because as you know, hard drives fail all the time. They're not meant to last. So having two copies ensures that if one drive fails, you have another. The third thing you want to do is to document your video with basic information, like I said, like where, when, who shot the video, and basically what's going on, because raw footage is not always evident.
And what kind of support does a witness provide to people out in the general public who are doing this taping?
Yeah, so we have created resources on how to film a protest, how to use a mobile phone, and our activist guide to archiving video. So we've distributed this to activists all around the world, including activists in Ferguson. Some of our resources have been downloaded thousands of times since we've shared that, since that incident.
About 10 seconds.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Yvonne Ng is the senior activist for Witness, which trains and supports people using video in their fight for human rights, co-author of Activist Guide to Archiving Video, and we'll link to it online. I also want to do a post-show with you to talk about what some of the people who have written in about have questions for you. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berk, Renee Feltzer, Amato Nyamucheka, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters in Portland held an action at a fundraising dinner for Senators Jeff Merkley and Cory Booker to protest their support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
A judge sides with agrochemical companies to strike down a local GMO ban in Hawaii's Kauai County.
And officials at the Bonneville Power Administration have been using private email accounts to discuss public business in the wake of multiple scandals last year.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 28th, 2014. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Robert Barncord. A Northeast Portland homeowner who moved back into her foreclosed home with the help of community activists 2 years ago was forcibly evicted last week. Alicia Jackson L. was granted an appeal in May that put a stay on her eviction, but after that stay ran out, she was left without options and has now been removed from her home. Jackson L. has filed a legal challenge against Fox Capital Corporation, who were ruled to be the rightful owners of her home. About 50 people pitched tents in her yard, located in the 500 block of Northeast Bryant Street last May. They set up watch duty and worked with her to try to stop the eviction. However, no activists were present when the sheriffs arrived to evict Jackson from her home last night. She spoke with KBOO Today about her eviction and the struggle to save her home.
Alicia, I understand that you have now been evicted. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes. Actually, I have to make a correction. That's Alicia Jackson L. And the eviction actually happened last Thursday. What happened was Sunday, the 17th, early in the morning, when I got up, I noticed that the porta potty had been turned over. And now I know who did it. And Thursday, they had somebody follow me, and I went to the library on 15th and Fremont, and when I got there, and they got there right behind me, I noticed they didn't get out of their vehicle. It was a van, and when I went in, I was watching out to see when they left, so I noticed when they left, and so that kind of tells me that that's when they were actually in the house, the police and Fox Capital. And so when I got back, before I even got there, one of the green sheriff's cars, he was obviously looking for me, because when he saw me, he came right behind me, and he turned his lights on, but I didn't stop because I was almost at the house. And then so I pulled in the driveway, and then the sheriff, I think his name was Edwards or something, he was telling me that I've been evicted, and here's your paperwork. You know, he just threw it in the car, in the sunroof, because my windows were up. So immediately I started making calls. There were about maybe four or five, maybe more officers there. And they were in the house, and obviously they busted the door open. They had taken down all the banners and all the my flags and everything. And they had gone into my room, opened the closet door. I don't know what they expected to find in there, but that was a total invasion of privacy. So the sheriff, he kept telling me that I was being evicted. The so-called owner doesn't want me on the property, and I had to back up unless I wanted to be arrested for trespassing.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit of the history? I know that you've been fighting this foreclosure eviction for a couple of years now, and have had a lot of support, at least in the past, from solidarity activists and anti-foreclosure activists, people from Occupy Portland, We Are Oregon, and other groups.
I guess it started in 2008. I lost my job and I wasn't able to keep up with the payments. And so I started getting these notices, you know, you're being foreclosed, you're losing your home, and all this other stuff. And so we did evict before the sheriff came. And so I've been fighting mainly with Fox Capital. They're the last ones to hang on. Everybody else, you know, just dropped off.
So who owned the mortgage? Did they sell it to Fox Capital? And who's Fox Capital?
We don't know who owns the mortgage. And Fox Capital supposedly bought the property on the courthouse steps, but I doubt that's true. And and also there was a...
What part of town is your house located in? Do you feel there's a gentrification process going on that's contributed to the situation that you're in now?
Yes, yes, I do. It's in Northeast Portland, and gentrification always plays a part in evicting people, you know. So I know it's hard for people to keep going and keep the keep the struggle going. But it's something that we have to do. I know it's something that I have to do, and I'm not, like I keep saying, I'm not going to give up.
Again, I've been speaking with Alicia Jackson L., who has been fighting her foreclosure eviction from her home in Northeast Portland for a number of years and has now finally been evicted, her belongings being taken out of the home by Fox Capital, which plans to remodel and then sell her home. I'm Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
On Monday, Oregon's Land Use Board of Appeals sent industrial expansion plans for the Port of St. Helens back to the drawing board. The plans were challenged by the Columbia Riverkeeper and others who oppose Amber Energy's Morro Pacific project, which would export 8.8 million tons of coal from the U.S. to South Korea via the Columbia River. Brett Vandenhoevel, executive director of the Columbia Riverkeeper, said that the project was at the center of current efforts by energy companies to site export projects along the Columbia River estuary, an area that supports numerous bird species and is central to reclamation of salmon habitat. The Port of St. Helens, which owns the 1,700-acre Port Westward property that is the proposed site of the expansion, wants more space there for industry. In January, Columbia County Commissioners approved a rezoning to turn 838 acres of farmland there into industrial property. But the State Land Use Appeals Board, which resolves land use disputes, sent the decision back to the county, saying more analysis of its impact is needed.
Three successive directors of the Bonneville Power Administration, the BPA, have used private email accounts to discuss agency business with a political consultant, according to documents obtained by the watchdog group BPA Watch. The consultant, Tony Williams, has had BPA as a client since 2001 and has been paid about $1 million by the agency since then under a no-bid contract. Williams advises BPA on strategies for interacting with the federal and state governments as well as customers. This is part of efforts to obtain funding and to craft a public image, all the more necessary in recent years since the agency has been rocked by a hiring scandal and accusations that it retaliated against whistleblowers at Hanford. BPA is a federally created and funded agency tasked with operating dozens of dams in the Columbia River watershed and supplying hydroelectric power to the region, as well as maintaining the Hanford nuclear site in southern Washington state, one of the most polluted sites in the entire United States. As a federally funded agency, BPA's official documents and correspondence are subject to public records disclosure laws. However, private email accounts are exempt from these laws. The emails came to light after the departure of previous director Bill Drummond when BPA officials found a copy of a February 2013 email in a wastebasket in his office. In the email, Williams states that he and Drummond's predecessor Steve Wright had communicated by, quote, occasional emails to a very private account. Wright began his career as BPA director in 2001, the same year Williams entered into his no-bid contract with the agency. Wright was known as a political insider in Washington state, and many of the now public emails show Williams trying to cultivate the political clout of current director Elliot Mainzer, going so far as to suggest that he be put in charge of Mainzer's scheduling. The emails show Williams flattering Mainzer and offering to mediate as a third party in all of BPA's public relations dealings. The emails were obtained by BPA Watch as part of a Freedom of Information Act request. BPA took nearly a year to respond to this, although BPA had been investigating the emails internally since last November. Since the records went public last week, Mainzer has stated that he switched all of his communications over to his BPA account and told all BPA employees to do the same.
A protest was held last night in southeast Portland outside of a fundraising dinner for Senator Jeff Merkley. The protest challenged Merkley for his ongoing support of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Senator Merkley has long been a strong supporter of Israel's policies, voting most recently in favor of an increase in U.S. funding to Israel in the midst of the Israeli assault on Gaza. Merkley has already received $40,000 in campaign contributions from the Israel lobby so far in this election cycle. For more on last night's protest, KBOO's Kristen Yount spoke with Peter Miller with Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights.
Can you tell me a little bit about why this event and why Jeff Merkley?
Right. So Jeff Merkley, we had New Jersey Senator Cory Booker here as part of the fundraiser, and they had a dinner, and then following the dinner was going to be a movie at a theater a couple blocks away with a film about Cory Booker's mayoral campaign in Newark, New Jersey, called Street Fight, which was talking about Cory Booker's fight against a corrupt political machine as he tried to run for mayor. But unfortunately, both of these senators supported Israel's attack on Gaza and the killing of so many civilians and families that all of us are just so horrified and sort of disgusted that our political leadership voted so unanimously to support this attack. One of the statistics that comes out is that 142 Palestinian families in Gaza lost three or more loved ones at a time. So just multiple casualties, some whole families, grandfathers, fathers, mothers, uncles, aunts, cousins, children have been wiped out. And we're just so disgusted that this level of violence can be leveled against the people who are basically helpless and under a military occupation.
Tell me about how these senators support the attack on Gaza.
Well, you know, this attack on Gaza was supported by a unanimous vote of all senators, 100-0. It basically didn't, it held Hamas totally accountable and said Israel has a right to defend itself with no context or balance or anything. And also said that Israel and the United States get to dictate what kind of government the Palestinians have, meaning that they didn't want Hamas to be part of a unity government, which the Palestinians just agreed to. And the fact that they, Hamas joined a unity government with the Palestinian Authority was the primary reason, really, that Israel attacked Gaza. All this other stuff was really a pretext. They wanted to drive a spike into this new political unity. Senators not only voted then for this, but in the past, the U.S. Senate has supported the vetoing of U.N. resolutions or anything that might hold Israel accountable. They voted to, you know, disregard the Goldstone report that came out after Operation Cast Lead back in 2009, which tried to hold Israel accountable for numerous war crimes. So they've been aiding and abetting Israel's violent military behavior for decades now. And in response, Israel has gotten only more violent with each succeeding attack.
How did the protest turn out last night? I know you were in front of the restaurant while people were dining. Did they use the back door? What happened?
Well, it was a great event from our standpoint and not so great for the senators because we were right outside the windows of their banquet room that they were eating, and we were yelling the names of all the Gazans that had been killed, as many as we could, and the ages and stuff, and yelling them into the window. And it was very clear that they could hear us outside doing this their entire dinner. And as we read the names, I think we got more upset and angry because you'd start reading the names and you realize you just read the names of 10, 15 people that were all the same family, that had all been killed together, and that they're in there eating their dinner and have approved this just made us furious, frankly. And, of course, the irony for them is here they're having a political fundraiser, they're trying to raise support. They have a movie that talks about Cory Booker going out on the street to talk to his common people out there on the street. But here, because of their support for Israel, they have to sneak into the back door of the restaurant and then into the back door of the movie theater to avoid their constituents who are angry that they support these barbarous military attacks.
Can you please tell us where you can find more information about how to get in touch with your elected officials or how to join forces with people that want to support Gaza? Where can people go to do that?
Well, if you want to get more information, our website is auphr.org, and you can email us at info@auphr.org. And we have a calendar of events, and you can also on our website sign up to our email list, and we put out an events notice about once a week about Palestine and other related events in the Portland area.
Again, this is Peter Miller, and he is with Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount.
A federal judge in Hawaii has overturned a local measure that regulates the use of genetically modified organisms and pesticides in Kauai County. Officials in other counties in Hawaii are currently analyzing the implications of this week's court ruling, as several counties in Hawaii have already passed measures restricting GMOs or are considering such measures. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Sam Small, an activist in Maui, about the ruling.
In the ruling, Judge Barry Curran ruled that the court's ruling simply recognizes that the state of Hawaii has established a comprehensive framework for addressing the application of restricted-use pesticides and the planting of GMO crops. Are you saying that's incorrect, that the judge is wrong in his assessment of state law?
That's my belief in terms of the GMO crops. In terms of pesticides, he's not incorrect. In terms of pesticides, there is a framework. But there is no adequate regulatory framework when it comes to GMOs. It hasn't been an issue, so nobody's been pressured to write any regulations. The agrochemical companies have had free rein to do whatever they want because nobody really knew what they were doing. Now that we know what they're doing and we understand that there's a social health impact to what they're doing, as well as an environmental impact to what they're doing, we're putting pressure on them.
So is the main concern that you and the other folks in Maui and in Kauai have that the use of GMO crops will increase the use of pesticides, or are there other concerns as well?
Well, for me personally, and really I can only speak for Maui, that's where I live and that's where I'm engaged. And our concerns certainly are for the pesticides. You know, the jury's out, I guess, you know, on GMOs and whether the genetic, you know, they've lumped all of the GMOs together, you know, and that's not appropriate. The Academy of National Academy of Science says that you have to approach every modification on a case-by-case basis. And they've just lumped them all together, saying that there's a, you know, they make believe that there's this scientific consensus that all GMOs are safe. Well, that's, you know, that's just not true. There's reports from all around the world, studies from all around the world that are valid studies that are published in peer-reviewed journals that show that they are not necessarily safe, and all of the studies call for additional research to be done. And the companies, you know, they manufactured this notion of substantial equivalence to say that a GMO version of a crop is substantially the same as the original version of the crop. That's a concept that it's a marketing concept. That they brought into play, it came out of the world of medical devices, where one medical device was substantially equivalent to another medical device, and therefore it didn't need to go through a whole new testing. Well, somehow they perverted that and applied it to genetic organisms. And it's just not true. And They've built an entire, a very successful and powerful industry around this whole concept. And places like Hawaii have been, you know, taken over. The agricultural environment of these islands have been taken over by the agrochemical companies. They're chemical companies. They're not involved in farming. Though they pretend and they want the protection of farmers, but what they're doing is not farming. They're manufacturing a standardized seed product that they then distribute around the world. 80% of the BT poison corn seed is grown in Maui County, and it's distributed all around the world. It's a standardized commercial seed product for which they don't want any variances. They want that product to be uniform. And so to get a uniform product, they eliminate all the stress factors on their corn. To do that, they have to kill all the bugs, all the bacteria, all the fungus, all the mildew. And so they spray the fields with up to 80 different chemicals through the course of their growing cycle.
That was Sam Small, an environmental activist in Hawaii. At 9:30 tomorrow morning, tune in to KBOO for the full interview with Sam Small on the fight to ban GMOs and regulate pesticide use in the state of Hawaii.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6, with a profile of Ronald McDonald, a Chinook Indian who was the first English teacher in 19th century Japan. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be overcast, with a high of 79 and a low of 58. Today in history, the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833 received royal assent, abolishing slavery throughout the British Empire, and in 1955, Emmett Till was murdered in Mississippi for allegedly flirting with a white woman, and the unprecedented publicity surrounding the murder and the sham trial of the perpetrators helped galvanize the civil rights movement in the United States. The quote of the day is from James Baldwin, who said, "The law is supposed to be my servant and not my master, still less my torturer and my murderer."
It's about 28 minutes after 5 p.m. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Can you have your hypocrisy and eat it too? I don't think so, but Cargill Inc. is doing its damnedest to get away with its version of the old admonition that eating your cake today means not having it tomorrow. Cargill, the $2.3 billion a year food conglomerate, is a huge producer and user of food ingredients that contain genetically manipulated organisms. But it has a marketing problem. By huge margins, consumers here and around the world do not want to put those GMO frankenfoods on their family's tables. Thus, Cargill has been a ferocious, deep-pocket opponent of every state law and ballot initiative that would mandate the labeling of any product containing GMOs. Better that families be kept in the dark about what they're buying and eating, says Cargill. Better for its profits, that is. Indeed, the chairman of the conglomerate's board is also on the executive committee of the industry lobbying front that goes all out to kill every right-to-know provision for consumers. Any such label, he scolds, would be, quote, misleading. But whoa, what's this? It's a press release from Fortress Cargill, proclaiming that the diehard giant is now marketing a non-GMO soybean oil that, voila, announces on its label that the product is GMO-free. Has the diehard had a change of heart? Excuse me, but corporations don't have hearts. They have bottom lines, period. And the bottom line is that Cargill's terminally hypocritical honchos see dollars laying on the ground that they're not getting. So, weasels a company man with a cumbersome title of Food Ingredients Commercial Manager, Quote, despite the many merits of biotechnology, consumer interest in non-GMO ingredients is growing, creating opportunities for food manufacturers. This is Jim Hightower saying, that is the clearest expression you'll ever get of corporate integrity. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
In Detroit, more than a dozen activists and civil rights attorneys called on the mayor today to put a permanent moratorium on water shutoffs in the city. The People's Water Board Coalition said it is disappointed that 600 Detroit residents have had their water cut off this week in the midst of 90-degree weather. For more, Justin Wiedes with the Detroit Water Brigade spoke with KBOO's Kristen Yount today.
Just want to get an update on what's happening in Detroit currently. What's going on?
Hey, Kristen and everybody at KBOO. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm here in Detroit, and as many of you who've been following may know, the city began shutting off water to low-income residents a couple months ago. And then after some really intense grassroots pressure from activists and community leaders, they actually put a pause on the water shutoffs in July and August. And now we're actually at the beginning of the shutoff program's reinitiation. So it began again this week, and the city says it intends to ramp back up the water shutoff program. And so we are obviously mobilizing and getting ready for another showdown if the city continues to shut off water on the border.
I heard a report that since Tuesday, there have been thousands of shutoffs. Is that correct? Is that accurate?
You know, I can't confirm that number. The city has been pretty hush about how they're going to reinitiate the program. But what I can say is that before the moratorium, the pause on the shutoffs, the city had indicated that they were going to shut off as many as 3,000 families, I'm sorry, per week, and up to 100,000 accounts in total. And so we know that during the shutoff moratorium, some people were able to get in and get on payment plans that were affordable, and so they avoided shutoff. But there are still thousands and thousands of families that are delinquent on their bills and just can't afford the water rates that the city is charging, nearly twice the national average, if you look at the cost of water in Detroit. So it's very possible that thousands of people could still lose water in the coming weeks.
Was there not talk about a cap on how much the city can pay, can charge residents for water?
Yes, that's right. My organization, the Detroit Water Brigade, as well as many other grassroots groups here in the city, have been advocating for a very simple and straightforward water affordability plan. And what the water affordability plan would do is it would cap the amount that a family spends on water based on their income to 3% of their monthly income, meaning that if you're a household that, say, earns, $30,000 a year, or say, $2,000 or $2,500 a month, the most that you would ever find yourself paying for water would be about $40, $50, which is around the national average for water usage and costs in the United States. But because of Detroit's mismanagement of their water system and really many, many people leaving the city and the population going down to about one-third of what it was a few decades ago, the cost of water has jumped up tremendously for the people that have stayed. And the water department now finds itself in a situation where it's so in debt to Wall Street that it spends about 40 cents out of every dollar that it takes in from water bills on debt service alone. That's just paying the interest on its loans from Wall Street. And so that's obviously an unsustainable amount of debt. And just like any family or any entity in bankruptcy, like the city of Detroit, it's not reasonable to expect that the city is going to be able to pay all of that debt off. It needs to be forgiven so that Detroiters can have a fresh start and really begin on a new foot after the bankruptcy.
How could the debt be forgiven?
Well, as some of your listeners may know already, the city of Detroit is under emergency financial management. That means that the city is basically being run by a state-appointed financial manager, bypassing, you know, all of democratic principles of self-governance. But we're being told that this is a temporary measure to get the city's finances in order. Whether or not you agree with emergency management, I don't personally, but you have to acknowledge that in a bankruptcy, some of the debts will be forgiven, or what they call impaired. And we know that from a recent move that the city did make, which was called a tender offer, a bond tender offer, they basically refinanced a chunk of their water debt at lower interest rates. And this saved the city $250 million. It was a voluntary refinancing, meaning that the bondholders of the water department were not forced to take this cut. They voluntarily chose to because they knew that their bonds were rated junk status on the market anyway, and they weren't going to be able to get all of their money in their investment. So they took this voluntary cut, this refinancing, and it saved the city $250 million. If you compare that to the amount of money saved by the city's water shutoff program, when they tried to squeeze the money out of low-income people rather than investors, the whole water shutoff program, thousands of families shut off to water and agony and really a lot of stress and pain for many people, only garnered the city $2.6 million, which is a 1/100th of the money that was saved by making the banks pay and the investors. And so we see that if the city really wants to chart a path towards sustainability, it shouldn't be trying to wring money out of the lowest income residents, but really going to the banks and saying, Detroiters just can't pay for this water at the rates that they're currently being charged.
Thank you so much. For KBOO News, this is Kristen Yount.
A lawsuit filed today in Ferguson, Missouri, charged police with excessive use of force in putting down protests over the last 2 weeks. The lawsuit also alleges that police falsely arrested innocent bystanders amid attempts to quell widespread unrest after the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown. The five plaintiffs in the suit, filed Thursday, include a clinical social worker who says she and her 17-year-old son were roughed up and arrested after not evacuating a McDonald's quickly enough. A 23-year-old man says he was shot multiple times with rubber bullets and called racial slurs while walking through the protest zone to his mother's home. And one man says he was arrested for filming the disturbances. The lawsuit seeks $40 million in damages. Attorney Malik Shabazz said it could be broadened to include additional plaintiffs. Officials in Ferguson and Clayton have declined comment.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. GM is investing more money in the Spring Hill, Tennessee manufacturing plant, reopened in 2011 thanks to UAW collective bargaining. The plant had closed in 2009 when GM discontinued the Saturn brand in the wake of the economic meltdown and GM's managed bankruptcy. For the UAW, getting that plant working again was a priority in bargaining with GM. Today, the plant employs 1,575 workers. GM says it will build the Cadillac SRX at the Spring Hill plant. GM is also investing $191 million in the small gas engine program, retaining some 415 jobs. UAW Region 8 Director Ray Curry says this is proof that when workers are allowed to have a seat at the collective bargaining table, we are best positioned to make quality products and bring more jobs into our communities. GM Wednesday also announced a $49.7 million investment at the Bedford, Indiana castings plant for small gas engine components. There's a new twist to the UAW effort to get a majority of VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee to sign up as members of UAW Local 42 there. The same people who formed the anti-union group Southern Momentum are behind the move to form something that they call the American Council of Employees. They're calling it another union, but it's not clear why anti-union people would now try to form something they're calling a union. The UAW's Gary Castile says the new group he calls the Anti-Union Union doesn't stand much of a chance, since UAW Local 42 already has substantially more than 700 workers signed up and has reached a consensus with VW to recognize the UAW as the bargaining agent when a majority of workers join the UAW Local.
The UAW's Gary Castile says the new group he calls the Anti-Union Union doesn't stand much of a chance, since UAW Local 42 already has substantially more than 700 workers signed up and has reached a consensus with VW to recognize the UAW as the bargaining agent when a majority of workers join the UAW Local. The UAW narrowly lost an NLRB election at the VW plant in February. The U.S. Postal Service has until September 10th to appeal a ruling by an NLRB administrative law judge ordering the handover of secret documents and emails related to the outsourcing of postal work to Staples stores. The American Postal Workers Union alleges the agreement with Staples violates its labor agreement. APWU President Mark Demenstein says the union believes the Staples deal is a dirty deal, and he wants to expose it.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, along with rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tom Friedman, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said Thursday that Ebola cases in West Africa are increasing and that it will, quote, get worse before it gets better. The 2014 Ebola outbreak is already one of the worst in history, with more than 2,600 people infected and close to 1,600 having died. Among those who have died, 120 of them have been healthcare workers. The fact that the disease has killed so many healthcare workers makes the treatment of patients already infected and the prevention of further infections much more difficult. The World Health Organization, the WHO, estimates that in the three hardest-hit West African countries, Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, only one or two doctors are available to treat each 100,000 people, and these doctors are mostly in urban areas. Health ministers from across West Africa are due to meet in Ghana to discuss the growing crisis. The WHO issued a roadmap Thursday in an effort to respond to the urgent need to scale up the international response. It aims to stop Ebola transmission in affected countries within 6 to 9 months and prevent its spread internationally. Meanwhile, the medical charity Doctors Without Borders has branded the international response, quote, entirely inadequate.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan border police arrested 27 armed Pakistani citizens on Thursday as they crossed the border into Paktika province in a convoy of four vehicles, including one military vehicle. The men were armed with AK-47s and handguns. According to the Ministry of the Interior, all of the men were captured and transferred to Kabul for further questioning. Their motives and affiliations are as yet unclear, but cross-border raids by insurgents and the Taliban are frequent along the Afghan-Pakistan border. In other news, Afghan presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah has pulled his observers out of a recount of the votes from June's runoff election. In the interest of fairness, the United Nations has requested that his opponent, Ashraf Ghani, also withdraw his observers from the internationally monitored recount. This is the latest in a series of setbacks in the contentious race, which has been disheartening both for Afghanistan's voters, who turned out in record numbers 5 months ago for the initial election, and for foreign diplomats like U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who has made multiple trips to Afghanistan in recent months to broker a deal between the two sides. The U.S. is anxious to have a new Afghan president so he can sign a deal to allow some U.S. personnel to remain after the withdrawal of combat forces at the end of this year.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Friel and Kristen Yount. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Matthew Olson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joe Uris guest hosts Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, on Political Perspectives, we speak with Patrick Lovell about Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream, a documentary about the foreclosure crisis. At 10, hear Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, host Per Fagering speaks with Oregon author Doug Matheson about his new book, Actually Thinking Versus Just Believing. The contrast between believing and analytically thinking is the central theme of Doug's book. Call in with your opinions. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a KBOO member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. That's kboo.fm. And stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Matt.
Good night, Matt.
Good night.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Pro-Palestinian activists in California stopped Israeli-owned cargo ships from unloading olives, wines, and ceramics at busy marine terminals in Oakland, in Los Angeles, in Tacoma, and Seattle over the last week. Import records show that the targeted Israeli company, Zim Integrated Shipping Services, is also delivering millions of rounds of Israeli-manufactured small arms ammunition to the United States every year. Zim also delivers weapons systems components for the Israeli and Greek governments to contractors in the United States for repairs and upgrades. The Block the Boat action has expanded with an action planned for Tampa, Florida later this week. Locally, activists here in Portland briefly occupied the office of the security firm G4S, which is contracted with the Israeli prison system, to call for divestment from its Israeli contracts. Meanwhile, in England and Australia, activists challenging the Israeli aggression in Gaza have occupied the offices of the Israeli weapons firm Elbit Systems. For more, we'll go to an interview with one of the organizers of the Australian action.
So could you start off with explaining the groups that were involved in this direct action?
Yeah, sure. It was a coming together of four affinity groups, Whistleblowers Activists Citizens Alliance, which is my group, WACA, a group called Renegade Activists, that are long-time anti-war arms manufacturing activists, another group called Least Harm, who are committed to protecting and participating in actions to ensure that activists are not harmed, and, of course, our dear friends from the Melbourne Street Medics.
Okay, great. And the action targeted Elbit Systems. Could you talk about why you chose to target, you know, this particular business for this action?
Yeah, sure. You know, WACA, from its very inception, we were originally known as the WikiLeaks Australian Citizens Alliance, was really born out of response to, obviously, the work of WikiLeaks and protecting Julian Assange. But a major focus for all of the founding members and right up until this day continues to be the exposure of the military-industrial surveillance states and the way that it operates through private corporations profiteering off, basically, death and misery. So Elbit Systems had been a company that had been in our line of sight for quite a while, simply because they are part of that complex. For people that don't know, they are pretty much a wholly owned Israeli company. They are one of the largest Israeli arms and drone manufacturers. Recently, a spokesperson for the Israeli government boasted about how invaluable Elbit's drones had been in the current Operation Protective Edge strike massacre on Gaza. So this, you know, we, like everybody else around the world, have been watching what has been happening and are deeply, deeply disturbed. And so, you know, Elbit Systems was a clear target because, one, they are providing a lot of equipment and machinery to the Israeli government to continue its operation against Gaza. But secondly, you know, maybe people don't know, in Australia they also provide surveillance equipment, database management, all sorts of communication systems that assist Pine Gap and the US government and countries like Israel in geolocation and targeting of civilians with drones. And they're operating with the Australian Defence Force and the Australian Federal Police. On top of that, they were recently awarded late last year the contract for surveillance and the delivery of drones to the US Homeland Security around the American-Mexico border. So they're exporting apartheid and equipment that is used to target civilian population. And to find that they're operating in the inner city of Melbourne was really quite extraordinary. And we've just had enough. We've had enough of the mainstream media bias. We've had enough of the confusion around the behaviour of a militarised state against an unarmed population being described as defending itself. And really, you know, when it comes down to it, private corporations like Elbit are the only ones that profit off war. And during the Operation Protective Edge, their share prices went up 6.9%. So you really have to consider the fact that the only people that are making money out of this are private corporations. And that was the main reason why we targeted them. We felt that it's unacceptable that they're operating in Melbourne, in Australia at all, that this makes Australia complicit in the crimes against humanity and potential war crimes that are occurring in Gaza. And further, we did it to draw attention to the fact that they also have a relationship to the Australian Defence Forces and the Australian Federal Police. Now, we've seen the militarisation of the police force in Ferguson over in the States. We know that a similar situation is occurring here. And once again, it is these kind of companies that are getting the contract. So, you know, it was a two sort of staged action, I guess. One was to draw attention to what's happening in Gaza. And secondly, it was also to draw attention to how these kind of corporations are working and operating in our own country, and to send a clear message to our government and to the Israeli government that we find this no longer acceptable. And as part of the global call for boycott, divestment and sanctions, we believe the Australian government should end all military contracts with Elbit Systems, and that the international community should put arms trade embargoes on Israel in a similar way to what happened in South Africa under the apartheid state.
Yeah, it has been horrible to see the growing death toll in Gaza, and as well, even when the issue isn't in the media like it has been recently, when you get these escalations, yeah, there's the ongoing occupation as well. So it's just, yeah, a horrible situation all around, but it's great to see activists taking action all around the world, and that extending to Australia now. We covered the UK direct action on a recent episode, and now we've got similar actions in Melbourne. So did you want to talk about, yeah, what happened in the UK and how, yeah, if this inspired you to take the action here in Australia?
Well, you know, in some ways it proves the 100 monkey theory, because we'd been looking at Elbit, as I said earlier, for quite a while. So when we saw our friends in the UK, which, by the way, we hadn't discussed with them privately any sort of coordinated plan, but while we were getting ready to do it here, they jumped the gun and were up on the roof. We had a bit of a jokey conversation on Twitter on Friday. They were saying, you know, don't forget, guys, the record is 2 days occupation. So we've thrown down the gauntlet to our UK friends because we said to them, well, we broke the Guinness Book of Record for most protests in one day at the Peace Convergence around Anzac Day in Canberra. So we've taken on board that we need to occupy a space for 2 days if they try and break our record. So the games are on to shut down the military industrial surveillance complex across the globe. And I see our US friends have upped the ante and shut down a port overnight where an Israeli ship was about to dock in Oakland on the West Coast. So, look, a lot of the people that are in this global movement came out of the Transparency WikiLeaks movement and the uprisings, the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement. And that's probably the most beautiful thing that's come out of these globalized capacities to connect, is that we have stayed in contact with each other. We are feeling the same concerns around the corporatization of our democracies and the militarization of civilian space offline and online. And Gaza, in some respects, Palestine's issue is key to that because of the cooperation internationally by military and arms manufacturers and governments in assisting the Israeli government to continue to commit collective punishment on a civilian population. So we were really, really happy when we saw our UK friends up on the roof of another Elbit Systems subsidiary. And it did spur us on, I've got to say. You know, sometimes when you do these actions, you can feel like you're in a bit of a bubble and the media can really attack you, you know, for being fringe dwellers or professional protesters. So it was quite delightful, one, to see the amount of coverage that the UK occupation got and how intelligently they spoke about why they did what they did. And it really encouraged us to go ahead with our plans. And we hope that this continues to build as little affinity groups around the world recognize that, you know, really it isn't, there is no way to pressurize Western liberal democracies through petition and protest. It's almost become an ineffective tactic in some ways. And we are really strong believers in intervening, in citizens really stepping up and showing leadership, both in the peace and anti-war movement. And one way to do that in a similar way to the situation with the refugee activist community is to intervene at the point in the supply chain. For us here in Australia, and I know for our friends in the UK and the US, it's gotten to the point now where we have to go to the source, and that means going to corporations, shutting down their capacity to keep running business as usual. And, you know, the main point of direct action is always to draw attention to something that is being ignored and that needs to be dealt with. And what we need to deal with, I think, as a global community is the way we have enabled the military-industrial surveillance complex to infiltrate through corporations into all levels of government. And the ultimate outcome is, you know, if these companies are driven by profit, if that's the main motive of a corporation, then they are always going to want another war. They're always going to want more collective punishment. I think what's particularly insidious about Elbit Systems is the way they promote their communications, their drone, their tanks, their guns. You know, they promote them as battle-tested. So what that actually means, and I just really want the listeners to understand this, they are using the fact that they are bombing women, children, families, infrastructure, UN schools in Palestine to sell their wares to other governments and other defence forces. And part of the tagline is that it's battle-tested. What that means is, you know, the images that you see of small children being targeted on the beach is how Israel battle tests its equipment. And I think that this is just profoundly offensive to anyone that maintains a connection to humanity and compassion.
Yeah, definitely lots of horrible stuff going on, but it's great to see the healthy competition amongst activists to protest it. And we did have Cogo on from the Melbourne Street Medic Collective on episode 57 talking about that Guinness World Record breaking attempt there in Canberra. So definitely encourage people to check that out. And I'd also love to talk about more about the importance of direct action. But maybe before we get on to that, could you discuss the details of the action, how it went down, what kind of actions you did there?
So, look, we wanted to, obviously, our objective was to, one, shut the Elbit Systems factory down for as long as possible, and secondly, to draw attention to what they're actually doing in the leafy suburbs of Melbourne. So we got up in the middle of the night when most of you were probably just going off to bed, and we went across to Elbit Systems. We had a division of crew, so we had a roof crew and a ground crew. Altogether, there was probably about 30 people involved in the action. Six climbers with the help of three support people climbed up a 12-metre ladder in the dark onto the roof of Elbit Systems. And, you know, I've got to say, for a company that specializes in arms and surveillance communication, they really didn't see us coming at all. And once we had word from the roof crew that they were up and they were safe and they were ready, we came out of the dark in the front of the building. We locked down the front gate with four bike locks, and we brought along our own temporary fencing and a fake apartheid wall that we'd constructed out of cardboard at a secret location. And we erected that as a symbol not only of, you know, I think it's really important to note that Albert also does the surveillance, and their subsidiaries helped in the construction of what we consider could only be called an apartheid wall. So we really wanted to draw attention to the fact that not only are they involved in weapons manufacturing, drones manufacturing, but they really are responsible in the systemic denial of human rights to the Palestinian people through the construction and the surveillance of the apartheid wall. So, yeah, by the time the light came up, you know, in the morning over Melbourne, we had everything in place and it worked perfectly. We really wanted to create a interesting visual. We dropped a 9-metre banner off the roof once the light was up. And that said, Albert drones kill kids in Gaza. So, you know, those two combinations really sum up for us what is going on with a corporation like Albert. But they also sum up to us the major concerns that the international community has had for many, many years. And, you know, let's be real about this. The people of Palestine have been oppressed, you know, for a good on 60 years now, and it's getting worse and worse, and some would call it incremental genocide. So that was our aim, was to draw attention to the two issues, the current state of apartheid and the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. And I think we achieved that really effectively with some really simple, clean messaging and the wall as, you know, a symbol of what these kind of organisations are involved in.
Yeah, I think that was a really great action. It's great to see the pictures circulating around social media of, as you said, the sign talking about the killer.